Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The CIA is reportedly intensifying its search in Pakistan for an alleged 9/11 plotter who once roomed with 9/11 hijacker Muhammad Atta. The Pakistani military uncovered the former roommate's passport in the Taliban stronghold of South Waziristan. Well, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton could be saying, "I told you so." Yesterday, she angered Pakistanis by saying in unusually forceful language that she found it hard to believe that government officials didn't know where al-Qaeda operatives were hiding. James Gordon Meek is national security reporter for the New York Daily News. And James, it's your sources that say the CIA is increasing its efforts to find this man, Saeed Bahaji, a German citizen. But what else do we know about him?
Saeed Bahaji, who was a member of the Hamburg cell and identified as such in documents such as the 9/11 Commission's final report, you know, has been a kind of a obscure figure in the 9/11 narrative, but definitely an important one because Hamburg, Germany is where a lot of the operational planning for the 9/11 plot was conducted and where obviously Muhammad Atta, Ziad Jarrah, and facilitator Ramzi bin al-Shibah, who is now down at Gitmo, were all living prior to the attacks.
But as you say, Mr. Bahaji was mentioned in the 9/11 Commission report, and they described him as an insecure follower with no personality and limited knowledge of Islam. So what does it mean? What do officials say it means that his passport has showed up in Pakistan? And by the way, you have an interesting story about how it was really discovered it was his.
Well, a couple of things about that, Robin. First of all, the 9/11 Commission report also says that in spite of his limited knowledge of Islam, he did profess his desire for jihad and was given a heads up by Ramzi bin al-Shibah, who was supposed to be one of the hijackers but couldn't get a visa into the U.S., that he ought to, if he was going to go to Afghanistan, now would be a good time to go. So he left a week before the 9/11 attacks, and his passport, which was put on display for reporters yesterday, had a stamp that said September 4, 2001. An entry stamp. It's not entirely clear that the Pakistanis even realized that they had, you know, what they found in terms of this document. They put it on display with some other documents and some very, very old antique captured weapons from this South Waziristan military offensive. And it was the journalist who said, "Hey, do you know who this guy is?" And they sort of pointed to the passport, and it seemed to catch some of the Pakistani military guys off guard. But Bahaji, according to my sources, the CIA has kept track of this guy. I'm not going to tell you he was at the top of their hit list, but he has attained rank in al-Qaeda since 9/11. He is a senior propagandist and believed to be involved in operational activities. So I can say that I think the CIA is looking a lot harder for him now. Let me just add one thing, though. It is common practice for al-Qaeda operatives to hand over their travel documents to their security people when they enter the tribal areas. So he could have handed over his passport, you know, 8 years ago and could be long gone. But they do believe he's alive and he is an active operative in al-Qaeda.
Well, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has left Pakistan. And in fact, today she's saying that, yes, she made a very strong statement, but she felt she had to say something about the government there or someone there. She sort of added a caveat, someone in Pakistan knowing where al-Qaeda fighters are. What's the sense of those comments she made? Some have said she went off script.
I doubt she went off script. I think the pocket, you know, increasingly you've had American officials over, you know, look, just it wasn't that long ago, Robin, that no one in the U.S. government would even say that Osama bin Laden and his chief lieutenants were even in Pakistan. They would just say, you know, the Afghanistan-Pakistan tribal areas. Now they say it very definitively. So I think what she said yesterday about somebody in the government must know, it's hard to believe no one knows where these top al-Qaeda leaders are. I think her comments were spot on, and I think they were very deliberately delivered. I'm sure it did rattle people in Pakistan, but let's face it, that's where the hierarchy of al-Qaeda lives.
Well, the Pakistani military has deployed 30,000 troops in South Waziristan to fight about 8,000 militants there, and they're crowing that they're driving the militants into deeper areas. Exits are choked, but some are worried, and at least one resident is quoted in the New York Times as saying they worry that the opposite is happening, that the army is being sucked in, and that they're then going to be hit hard by terrorists.
Well, that may be true. The Pakistani military doesn't fare very well when they go up against the Taliban. They take very, very heavy casualties, typically. And that's great for them because then they can go out and say, hey, look at our commitment. So we really are fighting them. Mostly what they've been doing is airstrikes so far. I mean, they're never going to take South Waziristan. Good luck, guys. That's what I would say. That is a stronghold for the Taliban. It's a stronghold of the Pashtun warlords who give al-Qaeda safe haven. And I think it will continue to be so.
James Gordon Meek covers national security for the New York Daily News. James, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, on this Friday, we want to spend a little time on a great idea. If you've got kids or are thinking of someday leaving a legacy to someone, why not make it a list of the things you think they should know? Well, that became a particularly great idea when Johnny Cash did it, and the things he thought his daughter Roseanne should know were songs.
Motherless children have a hard time when the mother is gone. Motherless children have a hard time when the mother is gone.
Motherless Children is one of 12 songs on the new CD from Roseanne Cash. It's called The List, and it features 12 of the 100 songs on the list her dad gave her when she was 18. And Roseanne Cash joins us in the studio with the story. Welcome.
Thank you.
What happened? What sparked the list? What was going on?
What sparked the list was my ignorance. I was on the road with him, and we were riding on the bus, and he mentioned a song, and I said, I don't know that one.
What was the song? Do you even remember that?
No, I don't remember now, but he went through three or four songs that I didn't know, and then he said, okay. And he got out his legal pad, and he spent the rest of the afternoon making this list for me.
What was his attitude? What was...
Pensive. Very thoughtful. That's the image I have in my mind of him sitting there with his pencil raised above the legal pad, thinking about which song he was going to put next. And it was an exciting thing for him to do because he had all of these songs at his fingertips, kind of.
What an important thing.
It's an important thing. You know what's important is that I managed to save it for all these years.
I was just thinking it would be a treasure for anyone to have from a parent who's now died.
Yes.
But it becomes a national treasure because we get to know what Johnny Cash thought.
It's definitely a cultural treasure. I see it as a personal legacy, like if it were a martial arts secret or something, you know. But you're right, it's also a cultural treasure.
Well, you had some high-profile help on this project, Bruce Springsteen, Elvis Costello, Jeff Tweedy, Rufus Wainwright. By the way, did any of them already know this music? Did any of them say, oh, I want to do this one?
They all knew all of this music. They're all incredibly well-versed in American roots music and Southern music. So I didn't have to, say, oh, could you learn this? They knew it. But we asked them specifically, I asked Bruce if he would sing on Sea of Heartbreak, and he said yes.
And let's listen.
Sea of Heartbreak, lost love, loneliness, memories of
Roseanne Cash, as we listen to Bruce Springsteen and Sea of Heartbreak on your new CD, what were you listening to when your dad made this list? I mean, you didn't know some of these songs, but what did you know?
Well, I was a Beatles freak, first and foremost. I was president of my Beatles fan club when I was a pre-adolescent. And I grew up in California, so I was listening to Neil Young and Buffalo Springfield and Elton John and, Janis Joplin and then Joni Mitchell. So all of the singer-songwriters and the British Invasion, all of that I knew inside and out. But my mother was listening to Ray Charles and Marty Robbins, so those things kind of went in. And then, of course, my dad's music. But this list that he made for me was so specific to who he was that it wasn't just a list of music, it was himself. And that's the real beauty for me.
You've said that Long Black Veil is sort of the core of the list. How so?
I think so. There is no country music without Long Black Veil. It assimilates everything that's great about country music, the narrative, the really clear narrative. It's a murder ballad. the kind of cinematic quality to the scenes, the mournfulness, those minor chord changes, you know, it's got everything. That's what Lefty Frizzell's version was, the one I knew, you know, from childhood. And then my dad, of course, did a great version on Folsom Prison. So this was the one I felt most close to my dad when we were recording.
She walks these hills in a long black veil. She visits my grave when the night winds wail. Nobody knows, nobody sees, nobody knows but me.
Now, did he tell you as he made this list, Roseanne Cash, did Johnny Cash go through and say, this is why these are important, or did he let you find that out yourself?
He said some of them, why they were important. You know, he had a musicologist understanding of the evolution of country music, and so early folk songs were included, protest songs, Delta blues, gospel, all of those really important points in the evolution of country music. So that became clear when I read the list. My God, my dad has a musicologist understanding of this. And I actually heard him talk about it later on. He came to my daughter's kindergarten class and gave that overview in terms a five-year-old could understand.
Well, tell us a little bit about that, because, yes, Johnny Cash came to a kindergarten class and apparently delivered one of the greatest lectures
yes.
ever, and it wasn't,
recorded. I was sitting there listening to this, and my jaw was on my chest, and this mother next to me leaned over and said, someone should really be recording this. And, of course, you know, it was so impromptu that no one was.
Well, what did he say to a five-year-old about, you know, motherless children or 500 miles? I mean, what did he say?
As I recall, this was in 87, but as I recall, he talked about the importance of gospel and southern blues in the evolution of country music, and also folk and protest songs. There's two far corners away from each other, but they're both essential to the evolution of country music. So he talked about that in ways a child could understand. So he talked about Woody Guthrie as well as Sister Rosetta Tharpe, who was a deep gospel singer.
Right. Oh, to have been a fly on that wall.
To have been a fly on that wall, my goodness, I know. And so I feel like, well, the list is kind of giving tribute to that little performance he gave for the five-year-olds.
Well, let's listen to more. This is Heartaches by the Number, featuring Elvis Costello.
Now I've got heartaches by the number, troubles by the score. And every day you love me less, each day I love you more.
Roseanne Cash's new CD, The List, includes 12 songs her father Johnny thought she should know. Songs he considered essential American music. We'll have more with Roseanne after a break. And later, was Edgar Allan Poe killed by political dirty tricks? Here and Now.
That's the day my world will end.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Roseanne Cash about her new CD, The List. 12 songs from a list her dad gave her when she was 18. The songs Johnny Cash knew in his bones and thought that Roseanne should too.
The only thing different. Your picture, she's got you.
That's She's Got You from Roseanne Cash's new CD, The List. And Roseanne, I feel we should give credit to some of the people who wrote these songs. So tell us some of the songwriters here.
Well, there are very few who are still living.
Right.
That's the first thing I have to say. It's kind of heartbreaking that a lot of these songwriters, I can't hand deliver this CD to them. But Hank Cochran, who wrote She's Got You, is 80 years old, I believe. He's not well, and he came to hear me perform She's Got You. It just, you know, I was in tears. It was such an emotional evening. Merle Haggard, one of the greatest country songwriters who ever lived, wrote Silver Wings, is clearly still alive and a wonderful, still performing, you know. Yeah. Bob Dylan is another songwriter. Mary John Wilkin is the only woman of the songwriters, and she co-wrote Long Black Veil. She's not still living, but I met her in my late teens, and she was very instrumental in me becoming a songwriter.
Hmm. Oh, so now you get to pay homage.
Yes.
In a way. You mentioned Bob Dylan. Included is His Girl from the North Country. Your dad did a duet with Dylan.
In 69.
On Dylan's Nashville Skyline. Oh, let's listen to a little of that.
If you're traveling in the North Country Fair, where the winds hit heavy on the borderline.
When you sing this song, what does this song mean to you?
It's funny you bring up Girl from the North Country because I just performed it, you know, on Prairie Home
Prairie Companion. It was beautiful.
And I was starting to choke up again. Every time I start to sing this song, it's this feeling that everything has come full circle in my life. You know, I have images of my dad and Bob recording that song in 1969, which made me the coolest 14-year-old on the planet, by the way.
And you're still pretty cool, actually, having seen that.
You know, I just wish so much my dad could hear me singing Girl from the North Country. He wouldn't believe it.
Well, if you're traveling in the North Country Fair, where the winds hit heavy on the borderline, remember me to one who lives there.
Said that one of your regrets is that you never asked your dad to update the list.
Absolutely.
Obviously, another one is that, you know, he's not hearing you sing it.
Although, Robin, I don't think that I could have recorded this record with my parents still alive. It's that kind of thing. You don't really care about legacy until you can't ask them about it anymore.
Right.
Until that's what you have left, you know?
Right.
That's the bittersweet quality to this whole thing. But yes, I do regret not asking him to update the list so much. But oddly enough, my daughter, Chelsea Crowell, whose first record is coming out next month, called me and said, "Where's my list?"
Oh, isn't that great?
Isn't it great?
What will you put on it?
I have been thinking about it nonstop.
The Beatles.
Well, of course. But then you have to make this dividing line. Do you include the Beatles? Do you include British Invasion? Or is it just kind of, you know, American roots music? Then it's a whole other list.
What a great idea. By the way, any other regrets about your relationship with your dad?
Well, that I didn't ask for advice more often. You know, I was stubborn. I was independent. I was rebellious.
Gee, were you Johnny Cash's daughter? Something.
The apple doesn't fall far, right?
There.
I wish I had asked him for advice more.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm just realizing, talking to you, I'm reminded of how I once saw your dad almost be killed by one of his emus, I think it was.
You were on
the ranch. My then brother-in-law, Robert Duvall, had gone to and taken us to research Pentecostal preachers.
When he was doing the film. Yeah.
Your dad and his wife, June, were helping him do that, and they cooked up a big pot of food, and then your dad wanted to take us out to see all these exotic animals that he had. And this emu attacked him.
I remember that very well. He ended up in the hospital.
Well, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have
laughed. Yeah, no, I know. It was, but, you know, nearly killed by an emu. Everyone laughed about it.
He laughed about it. But, you know, in that moment, you know, watching him dive under this old pickup truck, He was just a guy.
Yeah, sure.
In a lot of ways.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and that's how I feel about the list, too. Johnny Cash didn't make the list for me. My dad made the list.
Yeah. You also say that you wish you'd thanked him more for the list. I mean, who knew?
I forgot I had it until 2005. It's just lucky it stayed in my box of letters and mementos I was keeping. Yeah.
Well, you're thanking him now.
I am.
Just a question. Did he put any of his songs?
He was very modest about that. I think there's only two of his on the list.
And they were?
I'll tell you later.
Oh, they're not on the CD.
They're not on the CD, but, you know, I really do want to do volume two.
Ah, so we'll find out then.
Yeah.
We'll find out then. That's Roseanne Cash. Her new CD, The List, includes some songs from the list of 100 songs her dad thought would be essential for her to know. Boy, I just think it would be great for everybody to sit down and do the same thing for their kids. Roseanne, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Oh, bury me beneath the willow, under the weeping willow tree.
Another song from the list. This is Bury Me Under the Weeping Willow by A.P. Carter, of course a relative of Roseanne's stepmom, June Carter Cash. Monday on Here and Now, how stimulus money is reaching rural America. That's Monday, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com, and the Institute of Contemporary Art on Boston's waterfront, presenting the work of a diverse range of contemporary artists, performers, and more, icaboston.org.
To Afghanistan now, where the UN is increasing security after that attack this week on a guest house that killed 5 UN workers. The Taliban is threatening to disrupt next Saturday's runoff presidential election. UN officials say violence shouldn't be allowed to derail the vote. But concerns about security and the political uncertainty after the fraudulent election in August are taking a toll on Afghanistan, especially on its economy. The BBC's Charles Haviland reports on how some business people in Kabul are faring.
This is the epicenter of Afghanistan's money exchange. There are hundreds of men here, each of them clutching wads of either foreign currency. I can see Saudi Arabian money, Pakistani money, I think, and also Afghanis, the Afghan currency. And all around me there are currency exchange shops. Not only that, there's a staircase leading up to a second and third level, all of them lined with the same money exchange shops, and there are branches of banks as well. In one of the shops, Haji Muhammad Amin Jankusti, a thick-set, turbaned Pashtun man, shares green tea and good yarns with friends. But there are no customers in here. The commotion outside is, in fact, deceptive. Exchange businesses like Haji Amin's are suffering badly because of the incessant political uncertainty.
One person will say one thing about the election, someone else will say something else. The elections have cut our business by about 50%. Our customers are businessmen. They get foreign currency from us to pay for goods from all over the world. But now the businessmen have stopped their work. They're not changing money, so that's affected our work too.
Just across town, another breed of businessmen is also suffering election-related blues.
And here we're giving people the smoke of the barbecue. It's on a stage of live music, a fountain for flowing water, and also...
Obaidullah Alam shows me how he's developing the garden of Afghan Fried Chicken Continental, his successful fast food joint. Just 22 years old, he's also put a VIP room on the floor above. But the second story is still an empty shell. He's planning a state-of-the-art conference room there. But what's the point, he says, if international organizations start pulling out because of political instability?
Everybody, the local organization, the international organization, even the Afghan government, just concentrated on election. And they forgot what they have left in the back. And what they left in the back is the economic circumstances in Afghanistan. Most of the organizations and hotels and international investors have stopped their investing in Afghanistan because everybody's doubting the future of Afghanistan. It might be a better future and it might be something worse.
But it's not been solid gloom for Afghan businesses. A machine cuts great sheaves of paper at the Masood Walid printing press. Its owner, Khair Mohammed, says he and others in the trade thrived producing election-related materials.
For our business, everything has its own season. While election, people who are going to elect themselves as a president or something else, they want to print posters and their advertisement for their positions. They refer to our company. In this case, we can get a little bit money, much more money than any other seasons.
But even for him, trade since August has slumped. And to make matters worse, the main road past his office recently closed down because of bomb attacks. This is where the Kabul River runs through the city centre, though just a trickle in this dry season. There's a man herding sheep along the muddy bank, which is sometimes the riverbed, and dozens of bicycles parked there. There's thriving commerce all over the place. Jewel shops, stalls selling pots and pans, clothing and carpets. Yet there's still a malaise in Afghan business. People like the fast food entrepreneur Ubaidullah Alam yearn for a rapid end to the current political uncertainty. Only with security and stability, says Ubaidullah, can he expand his plans.
Security will certainly enable me doing further investments in Afghanistan, not only constructing my third floor. I might have further plans to establish other franchises of my hotel in the rest of the provinces and provide a circumstantial chances of employment for the rest of Afghans in different provinces.
A lot of Afghans would cheer such sentiment, but for the moment they, like the business community, must wait.
The BBC's Charles Haviland reporting from Kabul. You're listening to Here and Now. Democrats say they'll have the votes to pass the health care bill unveiled in the House yesterday. It includes a more moderate public option, imposes a number of taxes and fees on insurers and medical device makers, and also includes a little-discussed provision that's considered a big victory for biotech companies. The provision would give biotechs a 12-year period of exclusivity when a new drug is created. That's 12 years before a generic version can hit the market. And our next guest says the crafting of this provision is a case study in how interest groups are shaping the contours of healthcare reform. Karen Tumulty is senior political correspondent for Time magazine. She joins us from the Monitor Studios in Washington, D.C. Karen, welcome.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here, Robin.
And as I read your writing, it's also an illustration of how powerful committee chairs like Henry Waxman are being beaten by lobbying. He was against this provision we're talking about. He helped pass legislation back in 1984 to get generics onto the market sooner to lower the cost of drugs. But that law doesn't apply to these new drugs. Biologics, what are they?
Biologics are different from traditional pharmaceuticals because they are created through biological processes rather than with chemicals.
Well, Herceptin is probably the best known of these drugs made from living matter rather than chemicals.
That's right. And they're extraordinarily effective, but they're also extraordinarily expensive. They can cost tens of thousands of dollars a year. In some cases, they can cost as much as $200,000 a year.
Right. And Herceptin, again, for breast cancer. But biologics now only comprise about 20% of drugs on the market, but you say that's going to leap. In fact, all medicine is expected to someday be from living matter rather than chemical. But as we said, right now they're expensive. And that's the company's argument for keeping exclusivity because they want to get more money in so that they can create more miracle drugs. So explain the politics. Who is backing biologics?
Well, it's a number of organizations. Of course, the most obvious one is the biotech industry. And increasingly, the traditional pharmaceutical industry, which is acquiring a lot of these little biotech companies. But you've also seen a number of advocacy groups for people with certain diseases come to their side. But what becomes hard to trace in all this is where the money is coming from, because very often you will see a new advocacy group spring up. And once you look into who their board of directors is and where their funding is coming from, you find out that it's all coming from the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah. Well, but most of the biotech firms are also in states that have universities and research hospitals. So you have politicians like the late Senator Ted Kennedy, who was very much in favor of a 12-year exclusivity period because of all the biotech work that's done here in the Boston area. You have many California politicians in favor as well.
Yes, the biotech industry, unlike the traditional pharmaceutical industry, which you have in basically a few states, places like New Jersey, North Carolina, this is an industry that is growing up everywhere, essentially, that you have a teaching hospital, a research hospital. And these are powerful institutions in congressmen and senators' home states. They're industries that are creating terrific jobs. So they are very, very powerful in Congress.
Well, and on the other side, you have people like blogger and breast cancer survivor Jane Hampshire. She calls this new provision giving these companies exclusivity a death sentence for my fellow breast cancer survivor. She talks about friends struggling to find ways to pay for cancer drugs. So on the other side, there are people who want generics out faster because they're cheaper. How powerful is the biotech industry organization, BIO, with its CEO, Jim Greenwood, a former Republican committee chair? How powerful are they?
They are extraordinarily powerful. They are essentially winning every battle in Congress. The Obama administration wants to give these drugs no more than 7 years of exclusivity. Henry Waxman, a very powerful committee chairman in the House Energy and Commerce Committee, said no, 5 years. The Federal Trade Commission has suggested that they get no period of exclusivity. They say that giving them too much of a window is going to actually dampen their incentive to innovate. And yet, every single vote, they are winning this 12-year period of exclusivity. Henry Waxman essentially got rolled by his own committee, something that is very rare. In the end, when they took the votes, it was 4-1 against him.
And how much is BIO, the Biotechnology Industry Organization, spending?
You know, it is really hard to trace all of this. But you take the biotech industry and the pharmaceutical industry, and by a significant amount, they are spending more than any other player right now on lobbying healthcare reform than any other industry player.
Well, in fact, I see one stat in your article that in the first 6 months of this year alone, drug and biotech companies and their trade associations spent more than $110 million. That's, as you calculate, $609,000 a day to lobby lawmakers. And I was thinking, if their biggest concern is that they want to have enough revenue to produce new drugs, boy, that could have been it right there.
Well, and that doesn't even count the extraordinary amounts they are giving in campaign contributions. This healthcare bill has been a growth industry for the influence industry here in Washington.
But again, they say that they need to have this exclusivity so that they can be positioned to make more miracle drugs down the road and not have generic drugs undercutting their revenue.
I think everybody acknowledges this is a balance here between giving them incentives and making sure that consumers have therapies out there that they can afford. And really, it is the question of where you strike that balance.
And one last question before we let you go. The health care bill unveiled in the House yesterday. It has what's being called public option light. Not as much of a public plan as some Democrats would have liked, but at least it has one. Might that public option plan help people who don't have insurance and can't afford these extraordinarily expensive biologic drugs? Might there be something there to offset the generics that aren't going to come on the market?
Well, there will be, but it will be a question of whether your insurance plan is actually willing to cover these drugs. I think, too, that one of the things that has not gotten as much attention in this House bill is the vast expansion that is anticipated in the Medicaid program.
That's where the people are going to go who are on this public option light.
That's right. Because they picked a weaker version of the public option, they didn't save as much money as they had anticipated. They came up $85 billion short. And the way that they dealt with this was to take 2.5 million people who might otherwise have been out there buying their insurance on the exchanges and put them in the Medicaid program. Now, this is a cheaper way to cover people, but if you look at some of the problems the Medicaid program is already having, there aren't enough providers even for the people who are already there. So the House has tried to help in some ways. They're going to expand the community health center program. They're going to do some things about reimbursement of providers who do take Medicaid patients. But I do think there is still a concern here that you may be giving people coverage, but they may not be able to go out and then find someone who will treat them.
Karen Tumulty, senior political correspondent for Time Magazine. Karen, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, just ahead, your letters and a whodunit. Just how did Edgar Allan Poe die? You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back to Here and Now, and we have a few minutes for your thoughts on the program. We heard a lot of your thoughts after yesterday's conversation with Nell Scovell, former writer for David Letterman, who's now speaking out about how she felt his office affairs led to sexual favoritism and a hostile environment for her. Matthew Anderson was one of many who wrote to say he was impressed with Nell's speaking out. All kudos to her for that, he writes. However, Matthew, an African-American and himself a writer, joined others who objected when, in calling for more female writers in Late Night, Nell said this.
And I'm not talking affirmative action. They shouldn't lower their standards, but that doesn't mean they can't reach out and encourage.
Here's a call from Marilyn Richardson in Watertown, Massachusetts.
The largest group to benefit from affirmative action has been white women. But the suggestion that somehow affirmative action automatically equals lowering standards in order to achieve diversity is insidious and just plain wrong.
Well, we called Nell Scovell today in California. She says she wished she'd spoken differently. She only meant she didn't want legal quotas imposed or shows told to hire, say, someone's daughter. She wants late-night all-male shows to want to hire women. Well, we also got a lot of response recently to our interview with journalist Max Blumenthal, whose book Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party, makes his case that the Christian right has wrested the GOP away from the center. Jim Thompson of Fort Mill, South Carolina, had this response.
Someone who had been involved with Republican politics, working in Ronald Reagan's 1976 campaign in New Hampshire, I really enjoyed the program because I'm one of those Reagan, Goldwater, Kemp Republicans who could no longer support the current Republican Party.
But Brendan Wolf of Fairbanks, Alaska, resented the insinuation that people, say, in the Tea Party protests are overly influenced by the Christian right. He writes, I'm willing to give Max Blumenthal the benefit of the doubt that there is actually some validity to be found in his vitriolic tirade against some people who've been influential Christian leaders. But people can be influenced by and adopt certain communication techniques from them without accepting any part of their message. I'm not a Protestant and do not pay particular attention to James Dobson or Pat Robertson. But you might also want to try an interview, say, Chuck Colson, since he was also really hammered by Blumenthal. Come to think of it, who wasn't? Well, Brendan, just so you know, we do have a standing invitation into James Dobson as well as one to Chuck Colson. Stay tuned. As always, we'd love to hear your thoughts on anything on the program. Go to hereandnow.org and just click on Contact Us. Well, finally, we leave you on this eve of All Hallows' Eve with a mystery story.
Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered weak and weary over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping, as of someone gently rapping at my chamber door.
Vincent Price, reading from Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven. Note to myself, I should read that tomorrow night. All year, there's been a slew of events to commemorate the 200th anniversary of Poe's birth here in Boston. But what about his death 160 years ago this month in Baltimore, Maryland? There are a number of theories about just how Poe met his untimely end. Nate DeMayo, producer of The Memory Palace, as this tale of Poe's strange and tragic last days.
He got on the wrong train. He was headed to New York from Philadelphia, but wound up in Baltimore instead. We can't be sure how it happened. We can't be sure about a lot of things that happened to Edgar Allan Poe between September 27th, when his train arrived, on October 7, 1849, when he died of something at Washington College Hospital. We don't know what killed him. People have spent 160 years sifting through the clues trying to figure it out, like Poe's detective trying to solve those murders in the Rue Morgue. Spoiler alert, it was the orangutan. But even if they dug Poe's body up and ran whatever sort of CSI history stuff they can do these days, the result might come back definitively cholera, or a brain lesion, or alcohol poisoning, or even rabies, all of which people have suggested. Now, while that might explain definitively why he died, we won't know what killed Edgar Allan Poe. But we know this. Poe was going to be married a few weeks later. His first wife, Virginia, had died 2 years earlier, 2 years before he got on the wrong train. Virginia was the love of his life, though she was his first cousin, and was 13 to his 27 when they married. It seems that one day in 1842, she was playing the piano and she started coughing. And if you've seen just about any movie set in the 19th century, you know what that means. And we know that as her consumption got worse, so did her husband's already problematic drinking. We also know that after Virginia died, Edgar met a poet from Providence and promised her he'd stop it with the booze if she agreed to marry him. She did, but he couldn't. Soon he was calling on his childhood sweetheart. She was the woman he was going to marry before he got on the wrong train. We know that Poe was in rough shape when he arrived in Baltimore, whether it was from cholera or rabies or anything else. Poe was in rough shape. But he probably wouldn't have just died. Something killed him. Something made him wind up delirious and banged up and near death, stretched out on a wooden plank outside a saloon on Lombard Street, wearing another man's clothes. Something made him shiver and hallucinate and slip in and out of a coma and shout out and flail until he had to be strapped into his hospital bed. And it was probably local politics. Poe was found on election day. And that saloon was a polling place in the city's 4th Ward. And the Whig Party needed a big turnout. And the 4th Ward Whigs had ways of getting a big turnout. It seems that Edgar Allan Poe spent his last day out in the world, his last day before he was taken to a hospital bed to die, voting. It seems that the man who wrote The Raven and Annabel Lee and The Telltale Heart had been kidnapped by thugs. They would do this back then. These thugs, it's really the only word for them. They would kidnap people just walking out at night. And then they'd drag them from polling place to polling place, forcing them to vote over and over again. Sometimes they would switch their clothes so they could go another round at the same place. And to ensure their compliance, they'd get them drunk or high on opium. And they'd beat them. And they'd keep them locked up in these small rooms until they had to go out again and vote. They call the practice cooping because they'd be cooped up until it was time to drag them back out and vote again. So it seems that the man who invented the detective story, the man who gave us the blueprint that yielded everything from Sherlock Holmes to Agatha Christie to Fletch to The Wire, speaking of terrible things happening in Baltimore, it seems that the first American writer to try and make his living by writing, and the 24 bucks he got for writing The Raven was nothing even back in the 1840s. The first American to make his living by writing, and not by family money or a professor's or reverend's salary. It seems that Edgar Allan Poe spent his last day out in the world being kidnapped and drugged and smacked around and dragged half-conscious all over Baltimore to commit basic voter fraud, to be stripped of his clothes and put in another man's before being dumped off, delirious and confused, and dying in some bar.